Welcome to the Second Reading Podcast from the University of Texas at Austin.
The Republicans were in the Democratic Party because there was only one party.
So I tell people on a regular basis, there is still a land of opportunity in America. It's called Texas.
The problem is these departures from the Constitution, they have become the norm.
At what point must a female senator raise her hand or her voice to be recognized over the male colleagues in the room?
And welcome back to another edition of the Second Reading Podcast. This one is, as you can tell already probably, is something of a special edition. On June 26th, Josh Blank and I were guests in a webinar put on by the Professional Advocacy Association of Texas, PAT, probably known to at least some, if not many of you. On the last poll that we released, the June University of Texas, Texas Politics Project poll. And for the webinar, we emphasized the results in the poll, and there were a lot of them that were directly related to the legislative session, with the addition of some other elements that we thought would interest that audience, some of the results from the 2026, bearing on the 2026 election, things like that. We've been experimenting, though, with behind the scenes with using video in the podcast. So since we had the video and the folks at PAT, particularly Allison Small, who's been so great to work with on a series of events with them, were game to let us repackage and represent that webinar as part of the Second Reading Podcast. So that's what we've done here. Now, if you're listening to this and not using the video file that should be attached to it, I would recommend that you go either to our website, texaspolitics.utexas.edu, and find the entry for this podcast that will have an embedded video player, or probably safest bet, go to our YouTube account under Texas Politics Project. Just search it in YouTube. You'll find it easily enough so that you can see the video. And it's not because we are so visually compelling, but because of the webinar format, this is a little different than our usual podcast format. It's a little bit more lecture-like, particularly given that there are a lot of slides of the graphics that we talk about, and we explicate directly from the slides in some parts of the webinar. So if you're just listening, it's probably going to be a little weird in the places where we say, you know, follow the blue line for Democrats, etc. I just think it's a better experience for you. So with that, thanks again to PAT for working with us on the event and letting us use the content. Again, particularly Allison Small of PAT, who produces these things as the frontline producer for their events and their web events, and is always terrific to work with. Give this a listen. Please let us know what you think. We're really looking for feedback on whether and how much and how to use video in the podcast, or whether to just avoid the whole thing overall. But it's a very much an ongoing consideration, so I'd be glad to hear from you. So with that, let's just go to the podcast. Hope you enjoy it. What we want to do today is talk a little bit about the poll that we just released yesterday, draw a few conclusions here and there, but mostly give you some data and then open it up for some Q&A. And we're going to do this in kind of a half academic, half podcast, half, improvised jam band model. Mm-hmm. So we'll move through some stuff, end on the Q&A. We can't see the chat because of the studio setup, but Allison and the PAT folks are monitoring that. So please, ask questions. If something's unclear, Allison will, convey to us that we've muddied something up or people have...
And that's if we don't jump in on top of each other to clear it up.
Yeah, which we're going to do.
So don't worry.
So that's the podcast part. So with that, Josh is going to talk a little bit about the poll, and then we'll dive into some of the results.
Yeah, this is sort of the vegetable portion of the meal. We'll try to go through it relatively quickly. The poll was in the field from June 6th to the 16th, so after the close of the session, but before the most recent vetoes, if you will. It's a sample of 1,200 self-declared registered voters here in the state of Texas. For the full sample, the margin of error is plus or minus 2.83%. It's a relatively beefy survey. It's about 15 minutes. We really cover a lot of ground in this survey, and we're going to cover a little bit of ground in this discussion. We collect this data over the internet using YouGov. Happy to talk about that in the Q&A if that's something people are interested in, but we'll just move past that for now. This is the 68th poll in the time series, a statewide poll going back to 2008. It's actually, we're getting up to almost 70. I'm excited for 75. Maybe we'll do something. We talked about it, we're going to do something at 50, and then we didn't. So now, yeah. Maybe 75. Again, everything that we're going to present today is available on the website. So all the data, all the graphics, top lines, crosstabs, and all for actually for every one of those 68 polls. And I should point out, even though we're really going to focus on today's the June survey and the data we just released this week, this is actually the third poll that we've conducted this year, so during the legislative session. And I actually see the fourth poll going back to December, where a significant portion of the survey work is primarily focused on the work of the legislature, the work of state leaders, the agenda, that kind of stuff. So even though we're going to focus on kind of where voters were at the end of the session and where they are right now in June, in this discussion, probably in the Q&A, we'll look at the broader arc if we don't talk about it even before then, I'm sure, right?
Yeah, I think that's right.
Okay. All right. So let's get going, yeah?
Okay. So let's talk a little bit about the legislative agenda now. As Josh was saying, the big part of this poll was focused on the broad issue areas and the more specific proposals and legislation that were circulating in the legislature during the session. We tested many issues.
I think it was 18
is the number in both.
Yeah,
our heads.
I think it's 18, yeah.
That's probably pretty close. So, you know, we had a pretty big menu to give people in asking about what they supported and what they didn't. So what I want to do is go through those results, and I'm going to flip through this stuff pretty quickly because I do want to make sure we get to Q&A. So we'll make this slide deck available. I think Pat will have the video available to members and to others. So if you see something you want us to go back to or, you know, flag it, and we'll be happy to go back. What we've done is broken this, in, as we did in the rollout post at our website, into three basic tiers of attitudes and how they bunched up in the poll. So this top tier basically is the issues that had support from about two-thirds or more, a little more than two-thirds. And that meant that there was a good deal of bipartisan overlap in most of these. I'm going to break down a few examples of that. But for those of you, you know, looking at the slide, as you think about this list, these are all items that were on the priority list of somebody in the leadership, you know, whether it was the lieutenant governor or the governor's emergency items. I don't know if I was surprised, but, you know, at just how much support there was for some of these items. Now, there were precedents in what we had seen before.
Yeah, the thing that sort of stands out is, you know, thinking about, again, all the polling we saw throughout the session, is we saw a real focus, you know, at least what I like to say, like in the fat part of the distribution of the electorate, on a lot of bread and butter stuff, which is why seeing something like the water supply move up to the top in terms of support is not surprising. One, it was pushed by leadership and pushed by the legislature, you know, and sort of sold in a lot of ways to the public that this was important. But also, you know, we know from a lot of polling, this was important to the public because yeah. They've been concerned about water. But they've been concerned about these really, you know, again, central kind of, I guess, like kitchen table, bread and butter kind of issues. So it's not surprising to see bipartisan support, right?
Right. And again, you look at that list, water supply, dementia prevention and research, you know, on those two, some of that is you don't have to have a lot of preformed opinions or a lot of partisan positioning to go, yeah, water, important in Texas, dementia, sure, who's, you know, we should look into that, et cetera. But, you know, some of these others are, you know, where you see the support's still high, but a little bit lower, public education a little lower, lowering property taxes, et cetera. So let's look at a few specific examples just to flesh that out. Okay, so this is a more specific kind of breakdown of the item on the water supply. Don't really have to dwell on this. As you see, very little opposition, but also to our point about these kind of, you know, predispositions on the issues and how that's going to shape the responses, only about 10% saying they don't know or don't have an opinion. You break down this by party. Blue bars are Democrats, gray independents, red are Republicans. You know, not a lot of partisan difference here. As I've got, you know, as we added to the slide, there's a relative parity in partisan support. So that's one of the patterns in these more consensual items. Property taxes, which we flagged, looks a little bit different in terms of the overall support. A few more people saying they don't know, have no opinion. Probably, I haven't looked, but my suspicion would be non-property owners, independents, renters.
Younger people.
Younger people. And then when you look at the party breakdown on that, that probably underlines that. Again, no lack of bipartisan support, but if you look at that high red bar at 65% and the strongly support, you know, you do see that Republican support both stronger and more intense than Democrats. But that said, you know, not a lot of Democrats opposing reducing property taxes, only 19%, only 6% strongly oppose. Not a news flash there, but underlines with some evidence why, even though Republicans lead a lot harder from the leadership position and the signaling by elected officials on property tax reduction than Democrats do, it's not as if Democrats are saying, don't give me any property tax reduction.
Yeah, and even I would also say, to the extent that there are arguments, you know, against property tax reduction that float around in Democratic circles having to do with public education funding, the point that this makes is even if those, you know, arguments are out there, they don't get a lot of purchase in the electorate.
Right. So public education system, also, you know, something that we've seen a lot of support for, you know, in all of this polling that Josh was talking about over across the last three, four polls. And even going back into previous years, a lot of public support, but the bipartisan support here looks, you know, kind of the flip, a little bit of the inverse of the last side we saw on the support side, much stronger and intense support among Democrats, but not a lot of dissent among Republicans. A bit, 22% opposing, or 22% of Republicans, you know, opposed, but not a lot of energy in opposing increases in public school spending. All right, so that brings us to this middle tier. Now, this middle tier, those internals start getting a little bit mixed, but, you know, this tier was defined, you know, by a couple, you know, and we'll see some gray areas here, but mainly this is half or more, or more than half, but less than the level of support that we saw in the previous. Now, this, in the previous slide, now, one could have put that top item on this list, the 65% supporting banning the use of cell phones, on the previous list. But we kind of moved it on to this in part because of the bare majority of Democrats that support it. So going down this list, taking a couple of more examples. I mean, actually, anything else you want to flag on that slide before I go to the examples?
No, go to the examples. Let's keep moving.
Yeah, I think that's right. Keep it going.
Yeah.
All right. So one of the key things, and still kind of a hanging out there possibly now that there's a special session, limiting the ability of judges to release people accused of serious crimes on bail. In other words, you know, I think what we think of internally more or less is kind of bail reform two.
Right.
Bail reform one was, you know, more on the looking out for unreasonable cases of, you know, where people are being held on bail simply because they can't afford it for minor things. In other words, many people on this call will be familiar with the kind of bipartisan movement for bail reform that was prominent now about a decade ago.
A
it
more.
Started probably two decades ago, but it probably peaked about a decade ago pre-COVID. Now that's moved. Bail reform two is making it harder for people to get bail, for, you know, at least certain people, people accused of serious crimes, undocumented migrants. Now, given that, you know, you look at this, and this is one of the variations in this middle tier in response to issues, very strong and intense Republican consensus on this, and an area where the Republican leadership has not been particularly divided, but pretty substantial Democratic divisions with, you know, slight plurality of, a plurality of Democrats in favor of this kind of bail reform, but far from the kind of consensus we saw in some of the earlier issues. Looking at one of the marquee issues at the in the early half of the session, but what I would argue has been successfully kind of moved out of the limelight through sustained effort, 53% supporting establishing ESAs, 21% strong opposed, with a big chunk, a quarter, not sure. Again, interesting pattern here. Republican consensus and Democratic divisions, but importantly, and we've been kind of beating this horse through the course of this issue, if you look at where I've kind of highlighted, or we've highlighted on the right side of the slide, the issue is just not that important to a bigger chunk of people. lots of folks that just don't have an opinion, or either, I don't think there was a neutral option on this, but it was, you know, a lot of don't knows. And that's been characteristic of the ESA issue all through this public debate. With a, you know, an increase as a result of the attention, it became more salient, and you saw more partisan structure, particularly in the Republican attitudes over time as Republican leaders sent strong signals. But still, in the end, it's kind of remarkable to me how this has moved as a result of the Republican emphasis during the last couple of sessions, but is now still kind of where it's been for a while now.
Well, and I think that goes back to the point that you made, which is that because for most people, it's just not a salient issue. And it, and despite the attention of the leadership, it's not going to become a salient issue. And what I, and just to make it real quick, you know, most voters in the electorate don't have kids in the schools. They're beyond, you know, child rearing years, all these sorts of things. And this is just not an issue that necessarily rises to the top, let's say, compared to the economy, compared to immigration and border security, compared to property taxes. And it doesn't even rise to the top when we start thinking about like what people are thinking about when considering the public education system, when thinking about funding, when thinking about testing, when thinking about, you know, essentially the overall quality of the system. This is relatively low, but to the extent that you see these attitudes, part of that is a reflection of the fact that, you know, people don't hold super, you know, I would say sophisticated views about, let's say, you know, the impact that this may or may not have positively or negatively on the system as a whole. That's far, far beyond the way that most people are engaging with this issue. So for most Republicans, this has been a priority issue. This is seen, you know, again, you can kind of spin it out how you want, but this is not a big stretch. For Democrats, it might surprise some people to see this degree of Democratic support or this lack of opposition, but it only makes sense when you sort of realize the fact that Democrats too are not really focused on what ultimately is going to be a program that's going to serve some small percentage of the entire school population in Texas.
Right. And I guess the one thing I would add to that without us getting bogged down on here too long is that that lack of, you know, it's kind of the finer point of thinking about salience, right? Is that the lack of salience and, you know, if you want to be, you know, a little more vernacular, you know, direct relevance to the average person, given the demographics you were talking about, that creates a lot of space for partisan signaling to shape people's attitudes that heretofore were either negatively disposed or not paying attention, or but once you started hearing the governor, the lieutenant governor, you know, now frankly President Trump saying, hey, these this kind of system is a this kind of a arrangement, it's a good policy issue, this is what Republicans should want, essentially, that fills in the space. All right, so another one from this tier, and I should mention, sorry about the cutoffs, we're having a we have a new website and a new back-end system, and it's cutting off some of our slides, so we're missing a couple of words in these titles. We'll fix that. But at any point, and then back to a typical comfort issue in Texas, particularly for Republicans, and particularly in this environment, support for directing state agencies and law enforcement to cooperate with the federal government in enforcing federal immigration policies in Texas. Now, this was an interesting set of results, and it was an interesting time to be in the field. Remember, the field dates on this were during the surge in immigration protests, the uptick, you know, the attention to the uptick in federal enforcement. And that shows up in this issue, right? So that, you know, one of the reasons this makes the middle tier is because of there's huge lopsided support that you see in this slide for the policy. Don't really have to go into explaining that. You know, every time I've been with you, somehow it comes up about the degree to which immigration and border security are binding issues for Republicans, but also more polarized opposition on the Democratic side, that 50% that strongly oppose. And, you know, we'll talk more as we go on. There's a dynamic at work here in terms of the relative position of immigration and the border on one hand, and the economy and economic related issues on the other, that is represents a significant shift in public opinion that we've seen in the last few years, really, the last couple.
And I mean, I'll just talk, you know, I don't want to talk about that, we'll come back to it, but I think, you know, you could say, as again, Jim's been here before, and if we're talking about any sort of result that is about an immigration enforcement policy, this is probably pretty close to what the results would look like. But setting, you know, what Jim was just talking about, there was sort of changes in the dynamic that's influencing, I think, Republican approaches to this. But on the Democratic side, which you can also see over time, you know, the impact of Trump and the impact of the sustained attention to immigration, and in particular immigration enforcement, tends to actually push Democrats back into a more, you know, I guess I would say, reticent yeah. stance towards these enforcement mechanisms than they would be during the Biden administration, during the surges that we saw,
right.
especially sort of in 2023 and going into 24.
Yeah, and you see that in some of the data that I don't think we have with us today, but you'll find that on the website, or you can text us or send us an email. But
it's a very dynamic environment.
You know,
right
it's
now.
A very dynamic environment, but there was a clear pattern going into the 2024 election in which Democratic attitudes mm-hmm. towards immigration and particularly on the border shifted in a more, you know, center right or right yeah. direction as a result of what was going on the border.
And that's over. I mean,
and that's now pretty much over. Okay, quickly, the bottom tier support for the legislative agenda for legislative agenda items. Now, these are the issues that we hear a lot about. They get a lot of press coverage, a lot of media coverage. They're the ones that are more divisive. And if we were, you know, if you wanted to really oversimplify this a little bit, but I think it's, you know, with one important exception here, you know, what you could say is we go from this top tier of consensual issues to this bottom tier of much more polarized issue. We're moving from, broadly speaking, general election issues down into primary issues, yeah. right? So a few examples on the you know, widely publicized measure that requires public schools to display the Ten Commandments in every classroom, clearly looking a little more polarized, you know, more support than opposition by a pretty, you know, by a decent margin, but fairly evenly divided. And again, this is a good example. You know, Josh and I have been putting together this, you know, intro level class. When I saw this, I'm like, ah, great example of polarization,
perfect.
Right? So don't really have to overly dwell on that. I think people in here probably have a sense of that. And then the issue of the day, if you will, outline the production and sale of hemp-derived cannabis products in Texas. And I haven't mentioned this to Josh. I did a quick media hit in, I think, Houston this morning on the radio, and we talked about this. And one of the follow-up questions was, well, did we ask, and this is going to give you a hemorrhage, but did you ask about different kinds of hemp products? Did you ask about, like, THC versus synthetic versus all very fair policy areas, but no, we did not. And I, you know, who knows? We may have to later. But what do you see here? I mean, interesting in terms of where we are with the looming special session in which this was the lever, if not the main purpose for that session, in my view. But 31% support, 53 in favor. But when you go and you look at the internals, very interesting, and an interesting public opinion lens for thinking about the outbreak of public hostilities, and I use the term public hostilities very deliberately here, between the governor and the lieutenant governor. You know, those Republican attitudes, very closely divided with, you know, if you have a close majority, you have a close plurality, 46%, those red bars of Republicans supporting the ban, but a non-trivial amount opposing, 39%, and then a quarter strongly opposed. And I think a lot of those quarters that are strongly opposed are on social media and more than willing to talk to reporters.
Yeah.
And so I think we're seeing that on this issue quite a bit. So we'll come back to that. Let's, you know, look at then step back. So, I mean, I think if you step back to summarize that section more than we already have, you see these issues in that top tier, very consistent with what we've seen in polling up to this point, and really polling in a lot of ways over the last couple of sessions, mm-hmm. as Josh put it, where there are these cluster of issues that the legislature has taken up, the leadership has prioritized, where there is bipartisan support. But there's then these other issues that then are more mixed, and it raises the question, so how do, when we ask Texans about what they thought about the legislature and how they did, remember, we were in the field right after the conclusion of the regular session. How did it reflect on them? Why don't you take
that
over?
Yeah, I mean, in short, not great. don't need to be a mystery here. So when we look at the overall results, we ask, you know, about approval of the Texas legislature. Only 26% of Texas voters said they approved of the job the legislature had done. That's the lowest approval going back to 2011, and it's also the second highest disapproval. One was The highest disapproval, it was in August 2021 at the end of the OG most conservative session in Texas history, when there was just a lot of real negative sentiment sort of floating around. And so when we look at this, we say, you know, this session, there's 45% disapproval. That's the plurality. And again, the net disapproval there is minus 19, which is about where we were in August of 2021. And while, you know, there is partisan distribution here, you know, 68% of Democrats disapprove of the job the legislature did, you know, Republicans aren't overwhelmingly positive either. Okay. What we find is 46% approving of the job the legislature did, 22% disapproving, but importantly here, a third either neutral, neither positive nor negative, neither approving nor disapproving, or don't know. And so one of the things that sort of stands out from this here is, I'd say two things, is one, you know, there's probably room to sell still, you know, because there is still a lot of attitude out there. But also, you know, you can start to see why, you know, essentially this isn't super positive overall, despite what we just showed you, is that, you know, there's, again, overwhelming Democratic disapproval. In addition, not overwhelming Republican plaudits for the work. Now, there's another question that we ask, that we've been asking regularly at the end of the last two sessions, we've done it again, about the impact the legislature has had on the lives of Texans like then. Basically, you know, the legislature's concluded, based on what they've done, do you think that they've made the lives of Texans like you better, worse, or no impact? And you can say a lot better, a little bit better. And here again, we find a pretty similar story. Only 22% say the legislature made their life better. 37% say they made their life worse. 19% say no impact. Only 3% of Texas voters said they've made their life a lot better.
That's, you know, even though I don't think, you know, they all have good jobs and there's no need to be overly empathetic, it does make me feel a little sorry for the legislature to look at that little teeny tiny 3%.
Well, it's like, what about the water?
What about my water?
But I mean, I think it's fair to say, you know, just to point this out, because one of the things that I think we always do, this is like one of my hobby horses, you got to say, well, compared to what, right? And if we look back and we say, you know, in June 2021, 34% said, and again, there's a lot of partisan division here, so that we don't expect anything to be through the roof here. 34% in June of 2021 said the legislature had made their lives better. 29% of June of 2023, it's 22% today. So that's a problem. Now, there's obviously partisan division here. We can look at that. Republicans, 37% said they made their lives a lot better, but only 5% said a lot better. 27% said the same or no impact, and 14% said worse. And so, you know, again, when you think about who the market is for the policies here, it's not as though Republicans are looking at the output and saying, oh, you've really hit it out of the park. Okay,
I think before you carry it through to the state leadership, the other thing that kind of goes along with this that we didn't include, trying to keep it manageable, is attention to the legislature.
That's super important here. And when we actually ask people, you know, okay, how much attention have you been paying to the legislature? Only 7% said they've been paying a lot of attention. Now, I should say this is pretty on par with what we see usually during a legislative session. However, usually as the session gets to the end, it starts to uptick. And I think in this session in particular, it was a little bit lower than what we normally see by the end, just a little bit. But of course, we're all talking about low numbers here. You know, 14% versus 7 is twice as high, so it's a lot. But I think, you know, what we're seeing, we can kind of come back to this, is, you know, we've talked about this a lot, this sort of, you know, information acquisition polarization, which is, you know, when Trump's in office, some people want to just consume every piece of media they can find. And a lot of people just stop and just tune it out. So it's not surprising to see the legislative attention go down. Also, a lot more competition.
Yeah. Well, okay. For political. Yeah, I mean, I think what happens is, you know, one of the many Trump factors here is that it exacerbates a pattern that we already know is there, which is people pay more attention to national politics than state politics. And when national politics is so stimulating like it is right now, to use a somewhat neutral term, you know, people pay attention less. And if you guys want to talk about that more in the Q&A, we actually have a battery of questions where we ask what people have heard a lot about. We'll reference it on a couple of other things, but it will come up. So, Josh, you want to carry through and just since you're doing approval ratings and
let's
take us through the state leadership?
Sure. So let's start here with the speaker. So Dustin Burroughs, I mean, I think the first thing that you want to take away from this is the fact that 54% of Texans either can't offer a positive or negative assessment or have no opinion of Dustin Burroughs. And I think if you're the speaker, that's good news, right? Overall, his approval is at 16 approve, 31 disapprove. Which is relatively negative, but I would say, you know, just to make it clear, this is not coming from Republicans. Among Republicans, he's at 28-13. With 60% not offering an opinion, which again, if you think about all the conflicts that's going on right now, if I had, you know, 60% of Republicans not having an opinion of me, I think I'd take it in that role, maybe.
Well, you know, I don't have to say to this audience, you know, revisit the whole rule about, you know, if you want to be speaker, at least in the old environment, it's not really great to be known statewide. Now, we had a conversation on one of our Nerdy for 30 things in which Brad Johnson was talking a little bit about how that, I think that rule has to be a little more qualified in this current media environment, particularly with social media. I'm open to that, but I also think that nonetheless, you know, if you're a speaker, it's still probably better to be lesser known than more well known.
Well, but. And the challenge is, and known for what, right? Yeah. I think one of the things is, you know, we have a speaker who's been endorsed by the president, right?
Yeah.
And one of the things.
He'll be happily known for that.
He'll be happily known for that. But one of the things that's notable in this poll, and this will come up again and again, is where you really see Burrow's disapproval go up is among independents.
Right.
So if you go just from April to now, his disapproval among independents goes up from 24% to 42%. So there might be a little bit of a cost to that.
Yeah, we might as well flag the independents now. We won't go into it if people want to ask. But, you know, we'll see independents trending pretty negative generally in a lot of these, and we don't, you know, we're probably furthering polarization maybe by not talking about that as much. And but just for those of you that are wondering and to remind you, and I think I've talked about it in this with this group before, but, you know, these are true independents in those gray bars. And in this sample, it's about 11%. So the leaners are folded into the partisan groups.
Yeah, and one of the reasons that I think, you know, we're going to keep focusing on that group is that, you know, if 2026 is going to be a tighter election here in Texas, like 2018 was a tighter election, then all of a sudden, you know, you don't want to, if you're statewide leadership, you don't want 60, 70% of independents holding a negative attitude about your job performance, about any, about
one
the president. One
wouldn't
think. We can look at Dan Patrick here, and what you'll notice is that he's underwater. 30% approve of the job he's doing, 42% disapprove. This is a pretty big shift from April when he was at 36 approve, 36% disapprove. And the negative 12 net rating is actually the worst in the time series for him. And 42% disapproving is actually tied for the max in this time series, which goes back over 42 polls. Now,
and just to help you all out, I mean,
yeah,
you know, for those of you, if you've got your screen minimized,
right,
you know, this is a noisy graph, you know, or a noisy chart, but the blue lines are approval, the orange lines are disapproval, and the green lines are either neither nor don't know. And the latest numbers that Josh is talking about on the far right of the slide, they'll be right on the edge of your screen, that 42, 30, 27.
Right, and that seems like it's pretty out there, but I think one of the things you might notice, even though this is noisy, if you look real closely, there's a bit of a sawtooth pattern. And what you'll notice for the lieutenant governor is that his disapproval tends to peak around June of odd numbered years, which I think you kind of know why. In this case in particular, after kind of spending a fair amount of the session at least being a little bit quieter, he's actually really honestly through the THC issue really put himself out there in a way that's probably driven these numbers up a little bit higher maybe. But I think the point I want to make here by talking about the sawtooth pattern is that as more voters in particular, more Democrats and independents start to turn to what the legislature has done, and in particular turn to its most noticed leaders, you tend to see people go from having no opinion to having a negative opinion, which is part of what contributes to that sawtooth. So whether the current, you know, pattern that we're looking at is just a reflection of the historical pattern and the nature of the job and its constitutional authority, or whether it's actually a reflection of some of his recent activities.
Himself,
yeah,
right.
It's going to take some more polling data to see what that looks like, but I think they're both contributing at this point.
And to be fair, we should note that, you know, the lieutenant governor started, you know, throwing things at reporters after we were in the field.
Right. Okay. So then what about the governor? Now you'll notice here, compared to the lieutenant governor, this is much steadier, right? Again, you don't have the issue of sort of the session and sort of the constitutional powers, you know, moving in and out. But nonetheless, the governor also is facing a little bit of a tougher environment than he has. 41% approve of the job he's doing, 45% disapprove. 41% approval is basically the governor's floor over this entire time series. But it's actually been 3 years since the governor has been underwater in terms of job approval, going back to June of 2022 when he was 43 approve, 46 disapprove. So again, this is tied for the lowest approval in the time series.
And just a flag, remember, yeah, June 2022 was kind of a uncharacteristically rough time for Greg Abbott. He'd been challenged in the primary. You know, there had been a lot of pushback on COVID as he, mm-hmm, you know, this was happening nationally a lot of places. And it's one of the things I really like about these trend, yeah, graphics, and that I think is one of the real, you know, virtues of the data that we have available, is that, you know, there's a nice little historical story in this, mm-hmm, in this trajectory.
Yeah, and I think, you know, I don't have the data up here because it'd just be a lot of data, but what's underlying this is a couple trajectories that I think, you know, Jim will probably pick up when talking about Trump here, so I won't go too much into them. But what you see is unified Democratic opposition to Abbott in these numbers. And normally there's a fair amount of Democratic approval. When I say a fair amount, what I mean is, you know, you might see double-digit Democratic approval for the governor, you know, throughout his time series from time to time. Republican approval stands at 77%. Usually it's a little bit higher than that. But where I think, you know, the governor, again, is really suffering a little bit in these numbers is with independents, once again, where only 18% of the job he's doing, that's a low in the time series, 60% disapprove, which is a high in the time series.
Right.
So what is overhanging all of this?
Yeah. So one of the things that we've been really kicking around is we've been looking at this data and obviously thinking about what's going on since Donald Trump was reelected is, you know, just how heavily Trump, you know, hovers over Republican politics and politics in general in the state. And we saw this in very direct terms. And I think, you know, we've come to take it for granted a little bit that, you know, the president is very energetic and direct in his political assertions. And, you know, pretty amazing during the session that we saw in a few particular episodes, the president directly intervening in a very public way in legislative politics, the intervention in the run-up to the House vote on the ESA bill, the intervention of the White House and its prominent mentioning by of not so much Trump directly, but the White House and Robert F. Kennedy Jr. during on the product labeling bill and on the larger kind of MAHA trope, movement, activism, I'm not sure.
Yeah.
I guess it's all those things.
I looked up Trump to make sure that that was right and it works.
During the session. And
just want to make sure it's exactly right.
And we're, and then, you know.
Endorsements too.
And then, at, you know, where we are right now with, and yeah, with the endorsements and races that kind of fell out of that, but it has been going on since the last cycle. And then finally, and I think critically at the moment, and we'll probably come back to this, the pressing for a special session on redistricting, which it looks like he is going to get. And we can talk about that in the Q&A. So, where is Trump in Texas right now? Well, you know, I've been kind of going round and round with people about this a little bit in that, you know, if you look at the approval numbers, Donald Trump is at 44 approve, 51 disapprove, which is the first time he's been in net negative territory clearly during his second term. It's a pretty low number historically,
yeah,
for where he is, though not only slightly. The approval number is within the historic band. If you go back and look at his approval numbers, his favorability ratings, the disapproval number is a little bit on the high end, but
it's,
not.
That's the highest in the two terms, I
yeah,
think.
Yeah, yeah, but not. But it's not. Well, I think it's only the highest by like a point.
Yeah,
right.
50% is.
Right.
Yeah.
You know, so
could
it's
be 40,
51.
Could be 49.
Was, right. So.
Yeah. Don't want to make too much of it.
Don't want to, you know, overdo, you know, but, and then when we look at the trend, you'll see another factor. This is what the partisan breakdown looks like. And this is why I think, you know, when, I think there was a lot of, what's the word I'm looking for? Maybe premature enthusiasm about these numbers among people that don't like the president or
yeah,
that are, you know, just, you know, partisans saying, oh, look, he's, you know, headlines, he's underwater, et cetera. But if you look at that those approval numbers and those red bars among Republicans, not a lot to worry about. Now, at 87%, most Republican incumbents would take an 87% favorability rating among their base to the bank. This is actually, you know, marks a decline. If you look at February, April, and this number, it's been dropping a couple points per poll.
Can you go back to that one thing?
Oh, yeah.
I just noticed something that's kind of worth pointing out here also is that, you know, one thing that's actually unique about Donald Trump's approval here is that the strong approval is higher than the somewhat approval.
Yeah, right, which you...
You don't normally see that. Normally it's actually a little bit flipped.
The other way around. And so, yeah, I think that's a good point. I mean, in other words, the intensity of the attachment to Trump is one of his biggest assets.
Right.
In strict political terms. But, you know, the flip side of that is, you know, you and I were talking yesterday, Josh, offline, you know, that 85% disapproves strongly among Democrats.
Right.
Is also, particularly if you're going into a midterm election in which Trump himself is not going to be on the ballot, but he is the undisputed, mm-hmm, symbolic and effective head of the Republican Party, It means he remains a powerful mobilizing point.
I mean, that almost illustrates that point perfectly.
Right. So if you look then at the trend here, and this is, again, just a, this is the favorability numbers at 50-44, or 50 unfavorable, 44
favorable.
You know, it looks a lot like those job approval numbers, but this really sort of illustrates, if you go back to where the, if you start a few polls back at that December poll where he's at 54% favorability, where he is the president-elect, it's gone down pretty steadily since then. But I think the thing to remember here is that this is to be expected, and let's look at the internals to help flesh that out. So this is the trend we were talking about among Republicans. You can see, you know, he's dropped about 8 points from the, and his favorability rating among Republicans has dropped about 8 points since December. You know, not great news, but also not something that I would look at and go, hey, you know what? Donald Trump's support among Republicans is collapsing. It is clearly not a lot of, you know, movement or upticks in the, in those lower realms. I think that, you know, this is part of the normal cycle. We were going back and looking at governor's numbers and presidential numbers, but particularly presidential numbers in the first 6 months of their term. And this pattern among both partisans and overall, very familiar and to be expected. Similarly, the disapproval numbers have gone up in the same period over among Democrats, but settling in the low 90s, if you were to draw a line through there, or, you know, high 80s, low 90s is about where we should expect this number to be after you get through, you know, the initial period of, you know, what you would call a relative honeymoon. But you get that 79%.
Yeah, well.
And, you know, where it goes up to 86, not only were there some Democrats that were, I think, were willing to moderate their views of Trump, there was also a lot of dissatisfaction with the Democratic Party, with the way the 2024 election was conducted. Independents, you know, as we've said before, you know, they're pretty negative about
everybody,
about most everybody.
That's their job.
You know, even though we know that independents, you know, I think there's got to be some caution here when it comes around to election time. Independents in Texas are, you know, have two competing impulses. I think they, as a group, they tend to be skeptical to negative about institutions and incumbents. But on the other hand, they also tend to lean in a conservative direction.
Yeah, they do. I mean, the tricky part here, I think you're right. I mean, we just have to wait and see. But the hard part is, because Donald Trump, I mean, look, independents are dissatisfied with whoever is in charge, because that's partially why they're independent. They don't like either party.
Right.
But when it's so clear who is in charge and who is dictating the politics, and it's one person primarily from most people's experience, it just, I would say, you know, it coalesces that negativity in one target, and that's the danger there.
Yeah, I mean, they are going to be negative about uniparty rule, whatever the party is.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
Okay. You know, I wish I could see some faces here, because I can't, because I would like to have, like, a hand raise moment where I could say, who knows what's in 165 days? I already told you, so you be quiet. Yeah. I'll just tell you. You know what it is? It's the filing deadline to be on the primary ballot for the 2026 election in Texas. That's a ways from now. So not surprisingly, only 9% of Texas voters say that they've heard a lot about the 2026 U.S. Senate race. I know everyone listening to this call and who's, you know, been around our world is, like, paying tons and tons of attention to this. I mean, even in the last week, there's been tons of news about this. This is not something that most voters are paying attention to. Just to give you a sense, you know, we ask about 13 different items in the, that are taking place in the news, different sort of political items. This one ranked dead last in terms of the share of Texas voters who say they've heard a lot about it. 29% have heard a lot about the efforts to ban hemp, 32% about the measles outbreak, 37% about efforts to conceal Joe Biden's, you know, health deficiencies, 63% about tariffs, 72% about deportations. This is not on people's radars right now. And that is bipartisan. It's not as though Republicans are paying attention to Democrats aren't, or vice versa. This is just not really there yet. Nonetheless, it's very interesting to people like us and everybody listening to this call. And so in a very inelegant way, I'm just going to tell you what this says really quickly, which is that what the polling consistently shows is that there's a weakness in John Cornyn's support, in particular among Republican voters compared to other statewide officials. So what does that look like? Setting, you know, again, I'm just going to read you some numbers here. Among Republicans, John Cornyn has the approval of 44%. Ken Paxton, 55%, so about 11 points more. John Cornyn's disapproval is at 27% among Republicans. Ken Paxton's is at 17, so about a 10-point split. We can go kind of down these groups, but if we get to the extremely conservative voters that we expect to dominate Republican primaries, John Cornyn sits at 48-32, approve-disapprove, Ken Paxton at 79-4. That's about a 30-point swing. So while that in and of itself sort of, I think, generates a lot of the interest that a lot of people are expressing, one of the things I'd like to point out here is we could probably take any Republican statewide official and replace Ken Paxton with that person. We could still witness these gaps.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things here is, you know, the historic pattern in Cornyn's numbers. You know, we frequently said, you know, Texans, you know, really damned John Cornyn with faint praise. But there's also, the, you know, but the balancing point of that is that John Cornyn has also won several elections in a row. So on one hand, look, there's no doubt about the fact that going into a Republican primary as of right now, Ken Paxton, much better positioned among, you know, those groups that we would expect to be high propensity Republican primary voters. But, you know, it's still pretty early and there's going to be a lot of money and a lot of, you know, money to be spent and road to be traveled in this race. And, you know, people are not thinking about this as a matchup yet. And so when you ask people a trial ballot, you know, you're going to get attitudes that are not particularly well considered, I would say, at this point. So,
we'll jump into Q&A probably here in a second. I'd say, you know, it's not like it's valueless to see some trial ballots at this point. Yeah. It tells you something, but I think, you know, anyone who kind of looks at this and say, hey, here we are, 165 days from the filing deadline. We don't know who all the candidates are, but in this hypothetical head-to-head matchup that's probably not going to exist, here's what we see so far. And I think, you know, that those results are reflecting these numbers that we're seeing. But I said there's going to be a lot of money spent. I'd say, you know, there's going to be a lot of candidates that we're not really sure of who they are yet, who may be splitting up votes. So this is all a dynamic environment as well.
All right, so we're going to open up for Q&A while Allison is queuing up those cues. Just a little where our stuff is. You can find all our stuff at Texas Politics, at the Texas Politics Project at that URL on the slide. We are still doing the second reading podcast available. That says Stitcher. It should be Spotify, YouTube, and Apple Podcasts. That's what I get for reusing a slide. You can find all of our data and the files and all the kinds of graphics that you've been treated to in this presentation at our website, and you can use them. So, you know, please use our stuff. This slide very quickly shows you, you know, how you can click on that icon that's on all of our individual items at our website, brings up the menu that you see on the right of the slide, enables you to download the graphics in multiple formats, and as part of our new web design, you can actually download the data itself that's embedded in those graphics as a CSV or in an Excel file.
Put it in your own presentations.
Yeah, so drop it in your own stuff for your clients, for holidays, etc. So thanks, keep in touch, and we're hoping for some questions. Let us know, Allison.
And we'll send out links to all that information as well in our follow-up email. You have answered most of the questions. I know Harvey asked about congressional redistricting, and if you could opine a little bit about that. And then also, have self-identified Democrats stayed static over the last few cycles?
Wait, what was that second question?
Oh, have self-identified Democrats stayed static over the last few cycles?
Okay. Redistricting, short answer, we didn't ask about it yet. It wasn't, and when we went in the field, while it was being rumbled about, it hadn't been, you know, really pushed. You know, I'd have to think about the few times that we've asked about redistricting in the past. It's one of those issues like the public, most members of the public generally don't have a lot of well-formed attitudes about it. It's going to be very sensitive to how you ask the question. And I think the partisan signaling will be as such that were we to ask, should they have a special session on redistricting, we'd get a lot of don't knows, and the people that had attitudes, there'd be a lot of partisan structure.
Yeah,
That'd be my expectation.
Then the other piece of this that I think about a lot in sort of the dynamics of Texas politics, especially when you have something like that that's not going to be something that people are thinking about. And honestly, in a lot of cases, don't even really understand or know what you're talking about, which requires so much of the question writing piece of this, is you start to think about what do the sides look like on this and who's spending money. And the thing I would say is, you know, on its face, just as it started, they do get into that kind of space, it's really easy to expect the opposition to the redistricting spending a lot of money talking about it. It's going to be harder for the pro-redistricting side to make as broad of a case again, to a broad share of the electorate as to why this is needed.
Right.
Because it's so political. It's so clearly political. So what's the argument?
Yeah, and there's a question, you know, and I think in the past, I mean, depending on what the Democratic response to this is, will, you know, if there is some kind of tactical, strategic effort to, I may start using strategical, though.
Strategical, that's good. That's
if there's a, you know, some kind of concerted efforts by Democrats to subvert this process in a kind of high visibility way that would be probably intended to help mobilize their voters going into 2026, that'll just further the partisan separation on the issue.
Yeah.
And then on Democratic ID.
So wait, he clarified independence. He wanted to know about independence, if they've sort of self-identified independent state static over the last few cycles.
I would say, yeah. I mean, yes, in terms of the way that we define independence. So this is this. Okay. You know, this comes down to a little bit of a definitional thing, right?
Yeah.
So because we generally look at true independence, and there's a whole, you know, too much time here to talk about why we do that. So what we do is when we classify partisans, we basically say, do you consider yourself a Democrat or Republican, an independent, something else? If they say that they're an independent, we say, okay, do you lean towards one party or the other? And if they say they do, we treat those people as partisans because when we look at all their attitudes, they look like partisans. They look like strong partisans in most cases. Now, it's in those groups, actually, though, that we see a lot of movement in and out over time, either into the middle partisan categories or back into it, right? We see less movement in the true independent category. So those are the people who initially said they were independent. We said, no, but do you lean towards a party and say, no, I'm an independent, I don't identify the party? That group has stayed relatively consistent.
So, usually it's between 9 and 12% of most of our samples, I think,
from
poll to poll.
So what ends up usually happening is that we see more, you know, more fluctuation in the leaners. You know, it's sort of in the sense of if there are people who like would say, you know, oh yeah, I usually lean towards this party, but I'm, you know, like right now I'm a little uncomfortable. You know, I've seen that at times in polling where, you know, the leaners kind of drop down a little bit. But generally speaking, the share of independents stays pretty static. I mean, you know, it's funny. It's one thing that I understand the point of the question in some ways to say, you know, are people just kind of like running away from the parties?
Yeah.
And it's like, you know, that's one way to look at it. But the other way to look at it is when the parties are so clearly different and stand for such kind of clearly different things, it's actually the case, I think, that can actually reinforce that running away from the party means that you just run over, you know,
yeah,
or you stay where you are. Because
you kind of go back to where your inclination
is. It's a negative partisanship thing.
You know, the designer of the methodology that we partially used to grab samples for this poll, Doug Rivers, was at UT, I don't know, five or eight years ago, before the pandemic. And YouGov had gathered, you know, some unbelievably, you know, ridiculously sized data set where they took a bunch of their American data and pooled it. And it was like a few hundred thousand cases or something to look at this. And what they found is that there was kind of, what Doug was arguing is that there's cyclical movement in which the dynamic that Josh is describing in our data is pretty evident in this big pool of national data, where it's not that people, you know, decide one day they're not going to be an independent and they go back. Responding to context, they kind of go, they change, and maybe they identify as partisan for a while, but then they kind of revert back to this leaning independent status, and they move back and forth.
Yeah, and another way to put it, and this is sort of like I don't think Harvey has this misconception, because Harvey knows a lot. But like there is a bit of a misconception sometimes, because I think especially in our world, when you meet someone who's like really an actual political independent, they're usually like really into politics because of the places that that doesn't actually define most political independents. Most political independents are actually pretty detached from politics. They're usually not paying a ton of attention. They're usually, you know, again, kind of lacking in attitude in some way. They don't like what's going on, but that might be like kind of their primary thing that orients them to politics. Whereas what I always say to people is like, you know, if you follow politics really closely and you're really interested in it and you have opinions, you know, you're probably going to be a partisan because like, you know, it's hard not to, unless you essentially don't engage. And so that's why I think there's a sense that like, well, with all this going on, are you going to see more people moving into, and it's like there's a lot of, you know, into the independent category. And it's like, well, there are reasons I think that could happen that are more dynamic, having to do with like the party system overall and what it means to be conservative and what the Democrats are up to. It's a whole bigger story than we have time for today.
Well, you know, part of it is the nature of partisanship, right? That once you become a partisan and you're interested, there's a reciprocal kind of mutually reinforcing effect between being a partisan and being interested in politics and holding attitudes.
Right.
And, you know, to Josh's point, I mean, you'll notice if we were to flip back through the slides, and I could get caught on this, but I don't think so. on the vast majority of those issue slides, if you look at the don't knows, the independents are the highest number of don't knows or no opinions. And that's a sign of that lack of engagement. And it also, for us, I think it validates our approach to how we define independence, frankly.
And we had one question in the Q&A. What is the current breakdown in Texas of RD and independents?
I don't have the numbers from this poll right in front of me, and this is just a snapshot in time. Oh, you might have actually the
yeah,
specific.
Go ahead.
Oh, you do.
I was you riff while I look it
I'll
up.
I'll riff. Yeah, no. It's gotten a little bit tighter over time. I think the gap was about 5 points, I believe, in the overall party ID. So plus five Republican. I think it was like 40. I want to say it's like 40. I'm just going to put it out there, and we'll see how close. I think it was like 45-40. No, 47-42.
47-42.
With 11% independent.
Yeah.
And that's kind of where it's been recently. It used to be a wider gap, I would say. You know, it was more common, you know, over 10 years ago, you know,
yeah.
five to 10 years ago to see about a 10-point gap in party ID. And just, you know, with all the dynamics that everybody talks about in the state, you know, regardless of what happens in any one individual election, you know, that sort of slow impact of demographic change, of partisan change has been ongoing. And so now we'd see a slightly tighter gap. And the truth is, I think, you know, with Trump in the White House and the impact that he has, especially on Democratic-leaning voters, we should expect to see some, you know, polling that looks like that, pretty tight. Again, whether it's ours or other people's, honestly, kind of going forward for quite a bit.
Yeah, and I, you know, one thing I would add to that is that, remember, you know, this is a pool of registered voters. Mm-hmm. The pool of registered voters is not the same as the pool of primary voters or the pool of general election voters in a midterm election year. Or the pool of, which is not the same as the pool of general election voters
right.
in a general election or midterm. I don't know which.
In other words,
there's a difference between this midterm
yeah.
presidential. As I realized I was leaning into you, I started to pull back. so at any rate, you know, that's also the thing to remember. I mean, and look, we obviously when somebody doesn't like the results of the poll, and just to get in the nitty gritty or you know whatever. You know, in this poll, there are Republican consultants and professional Republicans who are not liking the fact that some of the social media coverage is going, Trump's underwater, and, you know, et cetera, which I think is overplayed, as we were saying in the beginning. And so they say, well, that's if you've only got, you know, if it's only a 5% edge, well, Republicans won last time by 5 plus X or whatever it is. But, you know, the sample is... you know, probably in the ballpark of where that basic subset is, just like if you did a poll of the overall population, it would look a little differently. But it has been closing in recent years.
All right, well, that is the last question, unless y'all have anything else.
Thanks, y'all. Questions, get in touch, or be sure to visit the website. There's a lot more we didn't talk about. There's tons of stuff in this poll and lots of details. Probably on policies that many of you are interested in. So have a look.
And again, we'll send links as well as a recording of this discussion. Jim, if President Bush, can you say strategery? You can say strategical. So that's your new coined phrase.
Yeah, that makes me feel kind of out of date, Allison, but I'll take it.
Hey. A big thank you again for being here today. Stay tuned for information about our next events. We're going to try to do a media panel before the special session if it works for everyone's schedule. So stay tuned. And then we put a survey in the chat that we'll send out. If you have ideas for future events, let us know.
We didn't write that. Just want to be, we didn't write that survey.
Exactly. Thank you guys very much.
Thanks, right. Everybody. Take care.
Bye.
The Second Reading Podcast is a production of the Texas Politics Project at the University of Texas at Austin.